Welcome to Disrespect, exploring the stigma around disability, providing information and interviews to entertain and challenge listeners who care about, or care for, or may themselves have become someone with a disability. Disrespect welcomes to the show today John Clark, organizer for OCAP, Ontario Coalition Against Poverty. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much.
John, you had a event that saved some 40 people from eviction, you feel, in Toronto. What was that?
Yes, we organized essentially a takeover of one of the housing tribunal offices.
Right.
This was part of our campaign around fighting for an increase in social assistance rates and trying to restore the special diet supplement that has been cut by the McGuinty government. So we took about 50 of our member supporters into the tribunal and shut down the proceedings. There were 30 evictions. We don't know with their dependents how many people that would be, but certainly over 40 people that were facing eviction that day. All evictions that day were not followed through with. We demanded that the economic evictions that the McGuinty government continues to carry out through its housing tribunal must cease, and we also issued our call for a 40% increase in social assistance rates. And the event took place as part of an ongoing campaign to mobilize communities affected by the cut to resist them and to challenge this government.
I see. I'm sure some people are aware of the relationship between the special diet allowance and evictions, but I'm not sure that every listener is.
Right.
What is the relationship briefly between the two?
Well, essentially, you've had a situation where over the last 10 years, there's been a 40% reduction in the spending power of social assistance checks.
Mm-hmm.
It's led to a situation where the only way that people can pay their rent is by not eating properly, and the only way they can eat properly is by not being able to pay their rent. Hence, there's been an incredible increase in the number of economic evictions taking place. So when the Harris government, the predecessor of McGuinty, decided to cut social assistance rates, it's not by coincidence. A companion piece of legislation that followed in its heels was the gutting of protections for tenants that existed under the previous Landlord and Tenant Act and the introduction of a so-called Tenant Protection Act, including the Housing Tribunal. So the notion of denying people adequate income on the one hand and facilitating the process of evictions on the other is an interconnected aspect of the same agenda.
What you're describing is a process for deliberately making people homeless.
I think that's incontrovertibly the case.
What's the payoff?
The payoff is if you naively believe that governments serve the interests of the citizenry in general,
mm-hmm.
then it, of course, makes no sense. You create a situation where people don't have enough to live on, where people's health is compromised, where healthcare costs skyrocket,
mm-hmm.
where people are put on the streets and face intense dislocation in their lives. The cost to them, certainly, and to society as a whole is considerable and unfortunate.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, I wouldn't support the notion that governments actually do represent the interests of most people. They represent the interests of the richest people.
I see.
And consequently, if welfare rates are driven down to absolutely deplorable levels, you have a situation where people are forced into the most low-paying jobs on offer, and it's possible for employers to drive down wages. And if you have a group of people whose miserable income makes it impossible for them to pay their rent, then it's in the interests of landlords to have a speedy eviction process to put those people on the streets.
What the
consequences are for the broader society and for those individuals is not a matter of great concern to the governments or the people they really speak for.
I see. Well, that's pretty clear. And it's a negative subsidy to employers.
That's
especially the largest employers. In effect, it's a subsidy whose costs are deferred and whose benefits are supposed to be fairly immediate.
Yes, no, absolutely.
Yeah. So who ends up carrying the cost of this thing? It's the people who are disadvantaged and deprived of a decent wage end up paying this down the road, don't they?
Well, they certainly end up paying it in terms of their own misery, their own shortened life expectancy, all the adverse things that happen to them. But in terms of the advancement of the interests of most people in society, it's also distinctly disadvantageous to have that kind of situation. But again, it comes back to the simple proposition that I don't think McGuinty, any more than any of the other governments that have gone before him, are particularly concerned about those issues.
Yeah, we've gone into that in the past about the McGuinty government's focus on a middle-class swing vote to the exclusion of anything else, including the exclusion of 760,000 on fixed incomes in Ontario, their siblings, their parents, their caregivers, and their families, which seems to me a rather ill-thought-out denial of the reality of what little democracy we have left.
Yes, I think that's probably true. But, I mean, of course, if democracy represents most people asserting their wishes, their aspirations, I think that that what goes on in Queen's Park and who gets elected to Queen's Park is largely a secondary question. I think that what it requires is that people actually organize in their communities to organize resistance to this agenda.
Is this we would know as brokerage politics, where in place of old-style allegiances to parties, people hold allegiances to a constituency that's economically or socially defined or defined by a set of issues?
Well, I suppose that's true. I think people have to people based on the fact that their communities are under attack have to be prepared to unite. I mean, the kind of action that we carried out on Friday was very important in its own right and achieved some very palpable and immediate successes. But you know, what's posed is, if you think of the fact that you said yourself, there are 760,000 people on social assistance. If those people were organized into a cohesive force that could act along the lines that we've etched out, but on a much larger basis, it really would be impossible for them to proceed with what they're doing. It would be impossible for them to impoverish people. It would be impossible for them to evict people in the way they're doing. There would simply be too much of a political price to be paid for it. And that's precisely our goal through this campaign. Is we're now seeing thousands of people facing the loss of their special diet supplement because of the recent Liberal cut.
And this is actually going ahead. I understood it was challenged, and to my mind, that meant it was suspended. Not so.
No, not at all. It's unfolding. It's proceeding. This month, significant numbers of people are being cut off of the special diet supplement. Next month, it'll be even larger.
How much in a month? How many?
Well, we know through our own clinics, we signed up at least 8,000 people in Toronto for the special diet supplement. So
right.
All of those people, or the great bulk of them, face cutoff, except for a very small minority who can salvage something under the new policy by virtue of the specific medical conditions they may be suffering from.
In the shoes of these people who are having their special diets cut off, and given the objectionable nature of disclosing your medical condition, do you think it's wise for people whose special diet is threatened to divulge their medical condition in the interest of trying to keep it?
Well, that's an extremely tough question to answer. I mean, I think that people really have to make their own determinations. If people feel that the only way they can survive is to and they do have some basis for saving at least a portion of the income they've received through the special diet supplement, and they make that choice, we certainly understand. We also understand why someone might refuse to participate in the thing.
Yeah.
The real issue, I think, is to ensure that the special diet supplement is restored without this outrageous and invasive new setup.
How can they go ahead when it's been challenged?
Well, there's a challenge that's been launched through the Privacy Commissioner, but it certainly doesn't. There's nothing in the system that brings it to a halt pending the results of that inquiry.
Oh, I see. Are there any hopes that the inquiry could restore the benefits to those who have been cut, or is that an open question at this point?
Well, I suppose it's an open question. I personally would not think it. I think it would be unwise to pin our hopes on a favourable outcome of an inquiry by the Privacy Commission. We could be pleasantly surprised, but I tend to doubt it.
Right.
I think that what's more likely is...
He's provincially funded, right?
Yes.
Okay.
And I think what's more likely is a victory in the form of community pressure,
right,
forcing from the government a substantial increase in social assistance rates and possibly the restoration of the supplement.
And now we'll take a short break with the blues.
standing, standing on Cater Street one day. Well, I was standing on Cater Street one day. One dime is all that I had.
And now, back to our interview in progress.
What was your plan in continuing with your campaign with this occupation?
Well, the truth is actually that this is quite a favorable situation. It's true that large numbers of people are immediately facing cutoff, and that's horrendous. It's awful. But at the same time, the government itself now is pretty openly talking about an increase to social assistance rates in the next budget. And this is really a very favorable time to be putting pressure on them to achieve just that. So, I think we've got a real chance here. But an increase that comes from sort of like pious editorials in the Toronto Star, let's say,
yeah,
as opposed to an increase that's based on a realization that communities under attack are just not going to tolerate it anymore. That's two very, very different things.
Yeah.
And so we're seeking to the very best of our ability in these really quite critical weeks to do all we can to mobilize people directly affected and put as much pressure on the government as possible. In our office, we have a packed meeting of people who've come from 7 or 8 different cities, and we're all sitting around at this point talking and discussing about what actions can be carried out in different parts of the province and what new communities we can reach out to and get them involved. This is really quite an exciting situation to be in. We've got some real possibilities to mobilize people that are really affected by this issue and have a stake in this struggle.
So in Toronto, you've been mobilized out of your offices, but do you have other groups in Toronto mobilizing?
Well,
for this?
Toronto, there are various sort of, there are various allies that are active on the issue. A number of agencies that have spoken out on this, a whole series of dozens, in fact, of medical providers who've been very, very vocal on this question and have organized.
Yeah, I've interviewed Gary Block, yeah.
Yeah, but the most, I think probably it's also true that during this campaign we've actually seen a mobilization here in this city of communities affected that's really been quite unprecedented. A lot of different immigrant communities have been, the poor parts of those communities have been mobilized very, very effectively. What's been outstanding has been the level of mobilization from the Somali community based largely in the north and west of the city. Particularly the women, mothers within the community have been just at the forefront of this campaign in a way that's been incredible.
Do you have any plans to bring their awareness and their model of organization before other groups?
Well, I think that they continue to be at the front of things in terms of the struggle here, and are in a position through the very example they're setting to do that.
Right.
While I pointed to the Somali community as being outstanding, mm-hmm. In terms of being so much involved in this campaign and so numerically dominating it, really, but we've also seen other communities that have been very active, a whole layer of grouping of Vietnamese people from the Chinese community, a special Spanish-speaking initiative taken up around the special diet. Of course, in the context of Toronto, that kind of involvement is absolutely essential if you're going to mobilize the people that are actually poor in this city.
Yeah. Is this ethnic commitment reaching out from Toronto to encompass other communities yet?
In other communities where people have been active, it's generally been smaller communities with perhaps not such a large groupings of immigrant populations.
But, for sure.
But still, I think the same phenomenon, wherever the clinics were set up, wherever people came out to access the supplement and defend it, you've seen the same almost natural process of the people who are disproportionately affected by poverty playing a major role at the center of the thing.
I'm curious to find out what OCAP's point of view is on the agencies that are supposed to be alleviating these problems. Now, you have allies within some of these agencies. My feeling is that there are two problems here with remedying the situation by conventional means. One is the establishment left, and you remarked on pious editorials in the Toronto Star. The federal Liberals were accused in the last election of a culture of entitlement, but my feeling is the establishment left, some of whom are well-meaning, nevertheless claim the right to wear a white hat in these issues, regardless of the effect they have on bettering them. And this is an obstacle because people continue to turn to the establishment left for solutions and find out that when they have the power, there are other issues that top the agenda and these ones don't count. Do you feel that way?
Well, yeah, I think that, the whole edifice of poverty that exists is one of the cornerstones of it has been the means of advocating for people, the means of providing some level of community service to them has been set up through a network of agencies that are themselves funded by government and run by officials who are beholden to government. And that has had a profound impact in terms of containing the capacity for resistance in poor communities.
Why is that? Because people, you've actually marched into my second question. Is it because people go to these agencies for help, not realizing how beholden they are to the people that they have who've created the issues that have to be addressed?
Well, it's true. I think that is true. But what's also true is that the people who are set up and deemed to be the representatives of poor communities and certainly of immigrant communities are largely people who hold their position by virtue of government largesse of one kind or another, who actually are part of a network of mutual back-scratching and patronage.
So they're not accountable to the immigrant community, for example?
No, I think that's largely true, that the system has very carefully put in place a series of gatekeeping institutions whose role in the final analysis, while it may be fine to let off some pressure occasionally and say a few controversial things, essentially that network is there to divert and contain the capacity for resistance rather than to facilitate it.
Now, I think that's an accurate observation from my experience and from what people have told me on the show. Your feeling about legal aid, your feeling about the Ontario Human Rights Commission, these are certainly now provincially funded organizations that are beholden to the government. Are they resources for you? Or I know there are some radical clinics in Toronto, but I know also that that you could count the number of clinics who are truly committed to issues like this in Hamilton on your nose.
Right. Well, I think you must always, of course, if you function in this, actual living situation, you must always, seek any handhold you can, exploit any contradiction that exists, and forge any alliances that you can.
Right.
But at the same time, I think you have to also understand that fundamentally, what must be built is a movement amongst communities affected that actually breaks from the systems of control that are there to contain it, and certainly in terms of institutions like human rights commissions, etc., a social mobilization is infinitely more powerful and promising than a dozen imaginative challenges through one of those tribunals. And and similarly, communities, if they're going to unleash their real power, are not going to do it on the basis of being led by people whose paycheck comes from the government.
Exactly. What are your feelings about the future of this resistance and the budget that's coming up? It's a little early to make predictions, but your feelings?
Well, it's early to make predictions, but there's no question that this is going to be something that's really ongoing.
Yes.
People have seen their level of income forced down to such miserable levels that the effects of it are continuing to compound. I mean, people are worse under McGuinty than they were under Harris. The percentage of people being evicted continues to go up. The numbers of people using food banks and charity in order to survive continues to increase. And we've really reached a totally intolerable situation. And then we found a means to, through the special diet supplement, to somewhat address these issues, and that's been taken away from people. There's a great deal of anger.
Yes.
I think we've got a real shot at winning a fairly substantial and significant increase in social assistance rates, but that won't end it. People are going to continue to push for adequacy, for dignity, and it's not going to stop. I think...
Nor should it.
Indeed, and I think McGuinty's going to have to come to realize that that some sort of token gesture or some sort of cosmetic improvement in the situation is just not going to cut it. There's going to have to be a diverting of resources back into poor communities and a significant reversal of the common sense revolution. If that doesn't happen, then the resistance is just simply going to grow.
Yeah. Is there anything you want to say in conclusion as we draw the interview to a close?
No, I think we've covered a lot of ground.
All right. Yeah, I'm glad that we got to this, and we'll try and keep in touch with you and informed on the issue as it develops approaching the budget, which is, what, March the 31st?
Still, to the best of my knowledge, they haven't made a final announcement, but they are talking possibly in terms of March. I'm not sure how they would manage to go before the federal budget, but they seem to be talking along those lines at the moment.
Oh, I see. That's right. The federal budget's a factor, too.
Yeah.
So we may have a little more time to work than we think.
Let's hope.
All right.
Yep.
Thanks, John.
Thanks a lot.
Want you to tell me, pretty baby, who may your lover be? When I ask you that question, won't you make arrangements? Right for me, tell me now, baby, what can I do to change your mind? Want you to tell me, pretty baby, what can I do to change your mind? Now if he's pine top worried, baby, and bothered all the time. That old kitten is doing fine. She ain't no hot dog, baby. Really got no behind. Yeah. We'll be right back.
still crazy about you, baby. Just haven't got the price. It's a hot tone, baby. Swear nine is no dice. Yeah, I'm going back home, boys, and get my old gal soon. Going back home and get my old gal soon. She's a hot tone, baby. She got the same old kidney stew. Kidney stew. That old kidney stew is fine. Yes, kidney stew. That old kidney stew is fine. She don't carry on time when she got the same old piece of mind.
That was Pine Top Perkins and the Blue Ice Band from the album of the same name and Kidney Stew Blues. In the middle of the show, from Testament Records sampler, Blind Connie Williams and One Thin Dime. It's fundraising time. And if you think what we do is worthwhile and you'd like to contribute, send us something for our fundraising drive, the internet portion of which ends at the end of February. The address is 1280 1280 Main Street West, Suite B119, B119, Hamilton. Postal code L8S as in Sam, 4S4, LHS4S4. Please include the name of the show, Disrespect Radio. Send us a check for $5, $10, send us a promise, we'll call, and you can be satisfied listening to the show, knowing you're a virtual shareholder at CFMU 93.3 FM. You've given us the equipment and the time to bring my show to you. Disrespect is looking for and names of politicians who are friendly to people with disabilities and supportive of their goals. You can send us this information at radio.stories@gmail.com. radio.stories@gmail.com. And we'd also like to hear what you want to hear on Disrespect related to disability, discrimination, and equity. radio.stories@gmail.com. If you're interested in the show, if you'd like to learn how to do digital editing, send us your name and your email. Again, radio.stories@gmail.com. We're looking for a volunteer editor. Disrespect. We'll see you next week. The show is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.